people today are turning astray of the path that was left long ago. All we leave behind, time after time, is a legacy with nothing to show. Now our country is lost, and it's not without cost, for there's many who struggle every day. And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Like a plant, one day we'll wither away, and to this world we'll have to say goodbye. But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with another episode of Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. This episode is going to be a recording of a message I preached recently to the church in which I pastor, Mount Tabor Baptist Church, from 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3 deals with the leadership in the church. It looks at the various authority figures, including the pastor or the bishop and the deacons and their respective roles. But more than that, it looks at their qualifications and what is required for them in terms of their character. In order to be in those positions in the church, should be a good one for you, especially if you are of that kind of leadership, to be reminded of the kind of character that is necessary in order to be a leader. So I hope you can find value in that, and thank you for supporting the show and listening to the show.
And these names, probably some of them you have heard and some of them you probably have not heard of, but I'm sure that you are familiar with some of them. And I want you to, as I'm reading them, I want you to think about what is the one common denominator in all of these people. Paul Crouch, Lonnie Frisbee, Ted Haggard, Jimmy Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, Robert Tilton, Bishop Eddie Long, Dr. Albert Odell, Bob Moorhead, Robert Liard, Pat Macedi, Douglas Goodman, Paul Barnes, Earl Polk, Tony Alamo, Coy Privett, Doug Phillips, Michael Reed, Joe Barron, Frank Houston. Anybody know what's the common denominator in all those people? Scandals. Every one of them is a world-renowned preacher, evangelist, Christian leader of some kind who has fallen in a scandal. Which is scary. I could go on. The list could get a lot larger. And that just, I just did a quick search on the internet for pastors involved in scandals. And I got a big list like that, talking about what they were involved in. Most of them either had to do with money or sex. Believe that or not. I mean, that tragedy. And so it brings up the question, what kind of qualifications are there necessary for someone to be a church leader? What kind of qualifications are there? Are there certain character traits? Are there certain qualities that someone must possess if they are going to be in church leadership? Now, let me just say for a moment, the way that typical churches call a pastor is less than biblical. Let me say it that way. Usually the way that it works, and I've been in part of these processes, so you know I know firsthand, probably some of you have been on committees where you've called a pastor before, and you know kind of the process that takes place, but usually the way it is they call the association, or they call the local group, or whatever it is that's in charge of having the resumes. And then you get a bunch of resumes, and you look through those resumes, and it says, you know, so-and-so got their undergraduate degree here, and someone got their master's degree here, and they were able to do this, and they pastored this church, and they grew this church from this one to this one. It says nothing about the person's character, does it? All it talks about is all their qualifications from the business standpoint. And then they have the person come, and they meet the person. The person really comes, and they're, you know, they look like me. They look, you know, really nice, right? And then they're all dressed up, and they you know, they really put on the show. And then they preach for you, right? And they're great communicators because they've honed that one message that they use for preaching to a trial sermon. And people say, oh, this guy's a great communicator, right? They still haven't talked anything about his character, and they may do a background check or something like that, but that's about it. Is that really the way that churches should call their pastors? Not a bit. Well, let's talk about how they call deacons, right? The way they normally call a deacon is they say, well, you know, Mr. Smith over there, you know, he's got a good business hat on his mind. He runs a business for a while. He's been a manager for a little bit. And he's a good guy. He comes to church once in a while. Let's make him a deacon. Is that really the qualifications we should have for calling deacons? No. Well, thankfully, the scriptures give us some instruction on that. And some of it is hard-hitting. Others of it is real down-to-earth, sensible, practical things. And we're going to look at those here. And beginning in verse 1, we have through verse 7, the instructions for the qualifications of the elder or the bishop or the pastor. First of all, it says in verse 1, this is a faithful saying. If a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. Well, what is a bishop? The word means episkopos, or the word is episkopos. And from that, we have two words. We have epi and skopos. Well, skopos, we get our English word scope from. So those of you that are hunters, right, you have a scope on your hunting rifle, right, so you can see more clearly. You have a sight. And epi means over. And so literally what an episkopos is someone who has oversight over something. We might call them a supervisor in the business world, right? And so a bishop is someone who has oversight. Well, what's interesting in the scriptures is that we find that the bishop, the elder, and the pastor refer to the exact same office in the scriptures. For example, it says in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2, it says, shepherd the flock of God. That means being a pastor. Shepherd the flock of God, which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly. And then in Acts chapter 20, Paul calls the Ephesian elders out to speak with them. And so these are the elders in Ephesus. He calls them together and he says, therefore, take heed to yourselves and to the flock among which the Holy Spirit has made you overseers to shepherd the church of God. So here we have the elders being spoken of as overseers and also given the command to shepherd, to pastor. And so I believe that it refers to the same office. Now, throughout church history, we've seen this changed somewhat. If you are familiar with the way that more liturgical churches or hierarchical churches have, they have a structure where you have the local pastor, and then you have bishops over that, and you have archbishops over that, and then you even have, in the Catholic Church, you have a pope who's in charge of all of that. And, of course, that structure we don't see anywhere in the scriptures. What we see is we see the pastor, the elder, and the bishop all be in the same office, and it's in the local church. And so when we talk in this passage about these qualifications, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the local leader in the church. According to the scriptures, the pastor's role is to preach and to teach, according to 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 17, to help the spiritually weak in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, to care for the church in 1 Peter 5, and to ordain other leaders in 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 14. And it speaks to the issue of calling here. It says, this is a faithful saying, if a man desires the position of a bishop, he desires a good work. Now, the word desire there is used twice, but it's a different word in the original language. The first word carries the idea of an external desire, something that is grasped at, something that someone actually pursues, someone might put in a resume for, that kind of thing. The second desire is actually an internal desire. It is a burning passion. It is a will within someone to do it. And so combining those two words, what it says is that a bishop is someone who has an internal burning desire to serve the church in that way and then pursues it through an external means. And so that's what he has here. And he says that's a good work if someone desires for it. And then we have these qualifications that are given beginning in verse 2. It says a bishop then must be blameless. Well, we can just all go home right now. That's impossible, right? And the first thing we must realize is that the standards that are set here really are high standards. But the word also doesn't just mean completely without sin. That would be impossible. No one would be able to fill that position. But really what it means is that someone who is without accusation, Someone who's whose slate is clean. Someone who no charge would be able to be brought against that person. That's what is meant by being blameless. It's interesting to note that it is only used by Paul when he refers to Timothy here in these passages. Obviously, it would mean that a pastor that is in trouble with the law is outside of being blameless. This is an overarching requirement. In fact, all the other requirements in this passage really kind of fall underneath this one. And then secondly, it says, he must be the husband of one wife. Now, here's where it gets a little bit controversial. Now, it's difficult to translate what this really means, but it means a one-woman man. Well, what does a one-woman man mean? It probably means to exclude polygamists. Now, there were probably polygamists in the early church who had been converted out of paganism and had come to faith in Christ. And, of course, at that point, what did they do? Did they get rid of all their wives but one? I mean, that's a difficult situation. But certainly someone like that should not be in leadership. Now, hopefully, we don't have any polygamist practices around here, but there are still some in the world that do that. Secondly, it's probably meant to exclude all extramarital affairs. As we might imagine, pornography and any kind of affairs like that would be outside the bounds for any kind of pastor, any kind of Christian, really, much more so even a pastor. It could also mean men who have been married more than once if their wife is still living. They couldn't be a one-woman man because they would have divided loyalties. They would still be responsible in some regards, maybe if the other wife had taken care of their children or something like that, and they were married somehow. So that would make a difficult situation. Also, it would certainly exclude women. Now, despite all the controversial, even in the Southern Baptist Convention and even in the James River Baptist Association, in fact, a couple years ago, I believe it was the James River Baptist Association ordained a woman, and she pastored a church here in our association. And I think it's really hard, if we take these words as they seem to be clearly articulated, it's really hard for a woman to be a one-woman man. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And so it'd be really hard for a woman to fulfill the role of a bishop or an elder in that regard. And then we see also, thirdly, that this person is supposed to be temperate. I think the King James Version says here, vigilant. It means literally wineless, sober, free from the influences of drink, having a disciplined life. It probably is used metaphorically here to refer to clear-headedness, not influenced by anything that would cause their mind to be distracted. Obviously, there are laws against driving under influence for a reason, because the alcohol or whatever the chemical it is in the one's head is causing them to lack judgment. And so obviously, someone who would be of that same nature in the pulpit or in the leadership of the church would be a bad thing for the church. Number four, it says they're sober-minded. This means of sound mind, curbing one's desires and impulses. He must have a sound mind so that he can lead the people properly. Pastors should be level-headed, disciplined. He knows how to properly order his priorities and is serious about spiritual matters. Pastors shouldn't be just flippant about things. I've made that error on a few occasions, and it does not bode well for the church. And then fifthly, they must be of good behavior. The word here is actually cosmios. It's the word that is similar to what we use in our English word cosmos, means created order. And the idea behind it is that, of course, even in the first century, the pagans realized that the world was created with some kind of order. And so the idea is that the good behavior here carries the idea of being well-ordered. A pastor should be well-ordered. Now, knowing that, please don't look in my car, okay? But the idea is that they should have somewhat of an order about them. They shouldn't be sloppy. They shouldn't be messy. They shouldn't have things out of order and in chaos. Of course, we know the Lord is in order. He is a man of order or a God of order. And so the pastor should likewise be the same. It's the same word, by the way, that's used in 1 Peter for women wearing modest apparel. Sometimes we translate it as modest. Really, it means they're supposed to be in good order. And, of course, with that, of course, carries modesty as well. Seems to carry the idea in appropriate or fitting. A pastor who tells a joke when someone's mourning is not fitting. That's out of order. And in the same way, if I were to show up to worship on Sunday morning in gym shorts and tennis shoes, it'd be a little out of order, wouldn't it? And so, of course, those are extreme examples. But that's the idea that is carried out here in good behavior. Sixthly, the pastor is to be hospitable. being a good host, generous to guests. Bishops would often be hosting people in their homes. It was a great way to minister. And in fact, in the early church, what happened a lot of times is that Christians would be persecuted and they would lose their homes. And the pastor, the elder, the bishop, would be the one who would first step up and host them in his home. This is an excellent way to reach people with the gospel in the intimacies of one's home. And the gospel can be shared there effectively. It's a great means of discipleship. You know, there's just something about being in someone's home that provides a more open environment for sharing and for discipleship and instruction. So pastors should have open homes. And that doesn't mean a lot of times pastors have no privacy to themselves. And that's not necessarily a good thing. But it does mean that pastors need to have their homes open and need to be available for people to stop by and to disciple them within their homes. So pastors should lead their church in hospitality. It's like an ambassador. You know, the main role of an ambassador, a foreign ambassador, is to entertain strangers. It is to entertain people who are visiting in that area, to bring them into the embassy and to host them. And the same kind of thing is true for the pastor of a church. It's really difficult, by the way, and this is not at all criticizing this church, because you guys do really well with this, but there are some churches that pay their pastors almost nothing, and their pastors can't afford to be good hosts to anybody that comes to their house. And that shouldn't be the way it is. And then seventhly, we see that the pastor should be able to teach. By the way, this is the only qualification on a skill level basis that's given here. All the other qualifications have to do with character. This one has to do with actual skill, being able to teach. Obviously, if a pastor can't teach, how can he feed the flock? If he can't look at the scriptures and explain the scriptures to people, how are they ever going to learn? Whose job is it to do that? And so the pastor should be leading in that way. Now, this can be a growth process. I remember the first time that I preached. Joanna knows it really well as well. I was in seminary, and I was nearing the end of seminary. We just found out that Joanna was pregnant, and we were going to have Graham. And so that was all exciting. And I was grading for a professor, and he was going to go out of town. And he asked me, pretty short notice, if I could fill the pulpit for him. He had a little country church near where we went to school. And so I said, yeah, that's great. I'd love the opportunity. Well, like I said, it was kind of short notice, and I had a lot of stuff going on. So I did not prepare properly for it, for number one. Number two, I was still very young at speaking and teaching. And so I go to the church there, and I begin to preach, and it was pathetic. I mean, the people there were very gracious to stay and listen. And I get done, and we get into the car, and immediately Joanna starts crying. And, you know, she's got the baby emotions going on anyway, but add to that the difficulties of my message, and she just breaks down. Oh! Horrible. You're never going to be able to be a preacher when you preach like that. It was really encouraging words, you know. Needless to say, by the grace of God, that has improved to some extent. And so we're glad that that is a skill that can be learned as well as one that can be taught. And then number eight is not given to wine. In verse 3, it says that they are not given to wine. Literally, one who sits along with his wine, not a drunkard. This differs by temperate and sober-minded, which is used earlier, and more specifically, it's used with reference to alcohol. Now, it's interesting. Three times here, we've seen some kind of reference to being temperate, self-controlled, especially when it comes to the use of alcohol. It reminds me of a situation when I was in Womack Medical Hospital for the chaplaincy one summer when I was in school. And Womack Medical Center, of course, is the hospital attached to Fort Bragg. And while I was there, the office for the chaplaincy was right near the entrance to the little chapel. And about every hour, there was two full-time chaplains, and then I was working there part-time, and then we had this contracted priest that was working to help with some of the Catholic services and worship that needed to be done there. And so he really wasn't a chaplain. He was a priest that was contracted from the chaplaincy department to work with them. But anyway, he would do some visitation, whatever, and he'd come down about every hour on clockwork. He would come down, he'd go into the auditorium or to the chapel, and he'd go into the little vestibule where all the storage stuff was stored, and he'd spend a few minutes there, and he'd come back out and go back out and do his visitation. And I thought, that's just really weird. I mean, he's going there and pray. What's he doing in there? Well, one day I got enough courage to go and look. And so I, you know, snuck around the corner and I watched. And he would go into that little vestibule area and he would take out the wine that was used for the mass, put the cork back in it, put it back, and he walked. And he did that about every hour. That's not what you want in a pastor, okay? That just letting you know, that's somebody who is given to wine, okay? And then in number 9 is they must not be violent. The King James here has must not be a striker or a brawler. This usually goes along with eating and drinking. It also demonstrates the lack of self-control and inability to control one's emotions. Difficult people and difficult situations in the church must be handled with self-control, not with outbursts of wrath. I came across a story just the other day. You might want to look it up. I don't want to read it for the sake of time. But there was a pastor named Jensen Wallace on May 27th of this year who got into a fist fight in court over $500. That's not the kind of pastor you want, okay? Not violent. 10 is not greedy for money, but gentle. Greedy for money, I like the way King James says it. Greedy for filthy lucre. Sometimes it just has a way of saying language better than our common translations do. The idea is that the bishop should not be one who wants money so much that he cuts corners or makes shady deals or bribes. Money should not rule his life. After all, Jesus said, you cannot serve two masters. Either you will love the one and hate the other, or you will be loyal to the one and despise the other, but you cannot serve both God and mammon. And then he adds here, but gentle. And the word gentle here really is not a very good translation. It should be equitable. The idea is that he's not to be greedy for money, but instead he is to be equitable. He's to enter into fair deals, to fair actions and fair agreements. The idea is the pastor should not be trying to have evidence of ripping people off or taking bribes or showing favoritism. I remember in one church that I was in, I don't know why parishioners do this. I guess some people feel that they need to do this. But we had this one lady in our church who was, she was a good businesswoman. She was making a lot of money. And she got angry with something I said one time. And she says, well, I'll just withhold my tithe. You know, why did they do that, you know? But anyway, she said, well, I'll just withhold my tithe. And, you know, if I was concerned that much about money, I would change what I preached. But I'm not going to change what I preach. And so you're stuck with me. Anyway, if you want to withhold your tithe, well, you withhold your tithe. I'm still going to preach what I preach. Number 11 is not quarrelsome, not contentious. Already covered in the first dealing with fighting with the fists. Now he's talking about fighting with the mouth. And in Proverbs chapter 20, verse 3, it says, it is honorable for a man to stop striving since any fool can start a quarrel. Isn't that true? The wise person is the one who can step away from a quarrel. The wise one is one who can see a quarrel starting and then make it so it doesn't continue. That's somebody who is wise, and that's the kind of person you need for a pastor. An elder does not contribute to the disunity and disharmony, but rather actually helps to mitigate it. Number 12, not covetous. See, I'm making these things pretty fast, right? Number 12 is not covetous, not a lover of money. Pastors must be motivated by the love of God and the love of people, not money. It is best that the pastor not deal with the money of the church. I was wisely told in seminary that the pastor should avoid two things in the church. Number 1, not touching the women, and not touching the money. That was pretty good advice, isn't it? And, you know, just yesterday, in fact, I did a funeral here for Jimmy Bryant, and someone gave me a check to go to the memorial fund. Well, there was no one else here in the church to take it, so I took it. But as soon as I got it, I drove down to William and gave it to William. What if I had lost that thing? I could have been accused, right? I don't want that. So I'll let William lose it. No, I'm not saying. There you go. So anyway, number 13. One who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? He has to be a householder. He has to be one who manages his house well. If he doesn't have a house, he can't manage it well. So that's the first thing. He's got to have some kind of household that he's managing, and he must manage it well. Now, you need to have some grace with this, because as children are growing, they are learning, right? And so they can't be perfect as they go along. But if all the children are out of control, there's a problem there. And we, you know, we've had pastors in this community whose children have had children out of wedlock. And there's something about that family that we question, right? If that were the case. And there's an old saying growing up, when I was growing up anyway, about PKs. You know what PKs are? Pastor's kids, right? Preacher's kids. And the old saying is that sometimes the PKs are the wildest of kids. And that's a sad testimony, isn't it? I shouldn't be the, a lot of times, you know why that is? Because the pastor's so busy caring for the people of the church that he can't take care of his own family. And that's wrong priorities. The pastor needs to take care of his family first. If he can't take care of his family, how can he take care of the church? And so he needs to be able to rule as well, his household well. Listen to what it says in 1 Samuel chapter 2, verses 20 through to 25. It says, "Now Eli was very old, and he heard everything that his sons did to all Israel." Now Eli was a priest in Israel. It says, "And how they lay with the women who assembled at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. So he said to them, 'Why do you do such things? For I fear of your evil dealings, or for I hear of your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, for it is not a good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people transgress. If one man sins against another, God will judge him. But if a man sins against the Lord, who will intercede for him?' Nevertheless, they did not heed the voice of their father, because the Lord desired to kill them." Those are some harsh words, aren't they? But it indicates something very important, and that is that the pastor needs to be able to rule his house well. The house is the testing ground for the elder. There is so much that a man learns by being a father. The same can be learned in some respects in the marketplace, but it's learned so much better with so much sensitivity within the home. And then number 14, he should not be a novice, it says. "Lest being puffed up with pride, he fall into the same condemnation as the devil." Novice word here is the word neophyte. It means a new convert. And this just makes practical sense. You don't want the pastor being a new convert. You want him to have some maturity on. In fact, that's the whole reason why they're called elders, right? It's not so much that they lack hair or something like that. It's that they have some maturity about them. They're people that are older in the faith. Now, usually that comes with time, but very often it has to do with the spiritual maturity. The purpose then is to ensure that there's some extent of maturity among bishops. The church doesn't need a new convert leading it, no matter how charismatic they might be. No matter what the resume says, they might be a PhD in New Testament exposition. And they may have all the charismatic character to be able to bring in tons of people. But if they haven't been a Christian very long, it's going to flop somewhere. Because there needs to be some maturity there. This is, I think, what one of my favorite pastors, Paul Washer. If you haven't heard of Paul Washer, you need to look him up and hear some of his sermons. That they're real cutting to the heart. But this is what he says. He says, "The church is in a lot of trouble." At least that's what the people say anyway. "The problem is most of what the people call the church is not the church. And the church is not quite as in trouble as everyone thinks. As a matter of fact, the church today is absolutely beautiful. She's glorious. She's humble. She's broken. She's confessing her sin. The problem is what everyone calling is the church today isn't the church. Basically, by and large, what is called the church today is nothing more than a bunch of unconverted church people with unconverted pastors." Not only is the church sometimes headed by someone who is immature, sometimes the church is headed by someone who's not even converted. How tragic is that? There must be some evidence of maturity there. Number 15, "I must have good reputation. Moreover, he must have a good testimony," verse 7, "among those who are outside, lest he fall into a reproach and a snare of the devil." Outside there, of course, refers to those outside the church. That is the community at large. The idea behind this is you don't want the pastor to be someone who has a bad reputation in the community. You don't want the pastor to be someone whose name doesn't bring good feelings to the community. If you go and ask someone in the community, "Hey, I go to such and such a church. What's the name of the pastor there?" "Oh, well, I'll never go there." That's not a good thing, right? You want the pastor to have a good reputation in the community. And just in case we think that this passage here might be just a specific situation that Timothy was dealing with, Paul also says this over in Titus, which was another church leader that Paul was raising up in Crete. It says, "For this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you. If a man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination, for a bishop must be blameless, as a steward of God, not self-willed, not quick-tempered, not given to wine, not violent, not greedy for money, but hospitable, a lover of what is good, sober-minded, just, holy, self-controlled, holding fast the faithful word, as he had been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and to convict those who contradict." So what should we do with this? Well, a couple of applications. Number one, this is how you should evaluate your pastor. Okay? You should hold him to these standards. At the end of the year, we don't do this here, you should, but at the end of the year, when you call your pastor in for an evaluation, and you look and see how he's doing as a pastor, it should not be so much how many people is he getting into the church, although that's a decent standard. It shouldn't be so much whether or not he is singing on key. Please don't do that one, okay? It should be his character. What kind of character does he have in the reputation of the community? What kind of character does he exhibit in the pulpit and around people? And what kind of, and then whether or not he's able to teach. That should be your standard for qualification. So that's what I encourage you to hold me accountable to. Secondly, pray for me. Pray that I would more and more exhibit these qualities in my own life. And, you know, each Sunday I have on the bulletin insert to pray for pastors and church leaders, deacons. And I hope that you're doing that. And then thirdly, consider carefully what other churches are doing in the association as it relates to this. We should have a say in something like that. And then number four, if I should ever leave this church, this is the standard that you should use in calling your next pastor, is to use this standard. So now let's turn our direction to the deacons. That begins in verse 8. I've got 8 minutes to cover this. So we'll go a little faster. A lot of it is repeat, so it will just be a little bit faster, and we'll just cover some of it. But verse 8, it says, "Likewise, deacons must be reverent." Now, what is a deacon? Literally, it means one who is a servant. And literally, it means one who waits on tables. It is someone who serves within the church. Probably the first deacons, although not called deacons, were those appointed in chapter 6 of Acts to help the apostles and free up the apostles' time. Their role was to free up the apostles so that the apostles could be devoted to prayer and to the ministry of the word. And so we could take that by analogy and say that the deacon's role then seems to be to free up the pastor so that the pastor can be involved in the ministry of the word and in prayer. And what are the qualifications that he must possess? Well, number one, it says he must be reverent. He must be reverent. This word really carries the idea of two things. It's not really a translation that can be covered in just one word, but it means two things, combining gravity and dignity, seriousness and honorableness, seriousness and the purpose and the seriousness of purpose and self-respect. That's kind of the idea that's covered here when it's talking about reverend. I find it interesting that pastors are often called Reverend so-and-so. But nowhere in the Bible does it say the pastors are not supposed to be reverend. I mean, they are supposed to be reverend, okay? That's just bottom line. But it says here, clearly, deacon's qualification is to be reverent. And so, I find that interesting. Number two, it says it's not supposed to be double-tongued. They're not supposed to say one thing to one person, and then another thing to another person. Now, sadly, I'm sure you've encountered this with people before. Where if there is one, where they're in one group, usually it happens like this, okay? Church business meeting. Controversy. "We need new lights in the church." "Oh, we don't need new lights. These lights are fine." And so you have a division in the church, right? And then the deacon go around there trying to figure out who's on the side and what's things going on. And when they're with this group that says they need new lights, they're like, "Yeah, you know, we really probably do need new lights." And then they go over to this group, and this group says, "Oh, we don't need new lights. Our lights are fine." "Oh, yeah, you're right. Lights are fine. We don't need new lights." What are they doing? They're double-tongued. We can't have that. We need to have deacons who are willing to speak the truth in love. Or worse is if you have a situation that's even dealing with a person. And when you're with that person, you're one way. And when you're with somebody else, you're speaking badly about that person. That's not the way it is. Reminds me of the command of Jesus to let your yes be yes and your no, no. In other words, don't mislead people. And thirdly, it says the deacon is not to be given to much wine. Just as it was with the pastor, so it is with the deacon. And then number four, they're not supposed to be greedy for money. You know, very often it is that deacons are responsible a lot in the church for money. How to handle money, they're on all kinds of committees. Usually they're taking up the offering. Sometimes they're counting the money, depositing the money. A lot of them are, you know, oversight of the building programs and things like that. And so they're handling money on a regular basis. So it's important for them to be able to have an honorable character when it comes to that. It reminds me of John chapter 12, verse 6, as it speaks about Judas, the one who betrayed Jesus. Says, this he said, not that he cared for the poor. In other words, he said, you know, we should have sold that money and given to the poor. Remember that? He says this, he said, not that they cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and he had the money box and he used to take what was put into it. We need to be careful about that. And then number five, we see in verse 9, they must hold the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. It means they must be sincere in their belief and understanding the gospel and biblical doctrine so that they are not led astray themselves, but also that they can be able to be an aid to those who are led astray and to be able to encourage them. So they must hold fast to pure doctrine, pure conscience. Number 6, verse 10, it says, but these also first must be tested, then let them serve as deacons, being found blameless. Just as a bishop is to be mature in their character, so a deacon must be tested in their character as well. And they must prove through that testing that they are evaluated correctly. The form of the verb here indicates a continuous action. They must continually and regularly be tested. This whole idea, have you ever heard deacon emeritus for life? Honorable. But what happens if that person falls into sin? Well, they shouldn't be a deacon emeritus for life if that's the case, right? So we need to just be careful that we evaluate the deacons on a yearly basis, just as we would with anybody else, or even more frequently than that, to make sure that they are holding fast to the faith and doing the things that need to be done. And then also, we see in number 7, let deacons be the husband of one wife. This, of course, is the same instruction that is given for elders. Number 8, ruling their children in their own house as well. Again, similar to the bishops. They need to be able to have a right standing in that regard. And then verse 13, we come upon the promise of those who serve well as deacons. It says, for those who have served well as deacons obtain for themselves a good standing and great boldness in the faith which is in Christ Jesus. It's an honorable thing to do, to be able to serve as a deacon and to serve the church in that way. So my question is, deacons, how are you doing? If you were to evaluate yourself based upon these standards, how are you doing? Secondly, consider these standards the next time we choose a deacon. Sadly, what happens in a lot of churches, especially in country churches, little country churches like this, is they're lacking in deacons. Because they've got, you know, 100 people on the roll, 20 people show up. And supposedly, according to the Constitution, we're supposed to have, you know, five members, one deacon or something, right? And if you count every man in the church, there's not enough to be deacons. But we got to fill the quota, we got to fill the role. And so what happens is we go to somebody who's just, if he shows up once in a while and he's, you know, breathing, he becomes a deacon. That's not the way it should be, right? We need to be a little bit more careful than that. And then pray for the deacons that they would, of course, fit this bill. And then young men, even if you don't want to become a deacon, these are good standards for you to step up to and to be challenged by. And then real quickly, I know we're out of time, but I'm going to cover these real quick. I don't think I can cover them quick, but I'm going to do it anyway. We have the calling and the character of the wives, and we really see this in verse 11. And this is controversial because there are some who understand this verse to refer to deaconesses. Others mean it to refer to the wives of the leaders that are spoken here. And what makes it even more complicated is where it says in verse 11, likewise their wives, the word wives there, can mean wife or woman. It's the same word in Greek. And so it's somewhat controversial. It's probably a reference to wives and not to women in general. And it's probably a reference to the wives of the leaders here and not to deaconesses. The reason why is that there's a perfectly good way of explaining deaconess in the scripture, and that is using the word deacon in the feminine form in the Greek. And that's not used here. And so I prefer to call it the wives here. And so what is given to them as instruction? And you know, you probably heard the saying before that behind every good man is a great woman. And that, you know, that's probably true. I know it is in my life. And so it's important that the wives of the leaders in the church have good quality character as well. And so what do we see them being referred to here? First of all, it says they must be reverent. This is the same that is given to deacons. They must not be slanderers, not tattletales, not gossips, not one who... I can just see it going like this, you know. They get together with somebody else. Did you see what so-and-so wore today? I can't believe that they wore that. You know, that's not the behavior of a wife of a leader in the church. And then temperate, this is the same word that's used of pastors in verse 2. She should be able to control herself so that she does not go to the excess. Faithful in all things, it says. This carries the idea with trustworthiness. It reminds me of Proverbs chapter 31, where it says of the virtuous wife that her husband safely trusts in her, being faithful. And I think a lot of this applies to the idea of being able to keep things in confidence. A lot of times, pastors and deacons are privy to certain situations in the church that are not public knowledge and shouldn't be public knowledge. And yet, they're discussed with their husbands, those things. And it's important that the wives be able to keep those things in confidence and not get it spread around the church. I'm sure you have been in churches before where you knew of somebody that if they found out about it, the whole church would find out about it. And that's not the way it should be. They should be able to keep things in confidence. So wives of the leaders here in the church, how are we doing? Could you be able to meet these qualifications and these standards? And then again, pray. Pray for those who are in positions such as this. So my concluding marks then is, where are all the men? You know, we criticize churches sometimes that have women leaders. Well, I think a lot of times that's because the men just don't step up. And I think that if the men were to step up, we wouldn't have that problem anymore. And so my question is, where are the men? Step up, men. Take on the roles of leaders. Take on the roles that you're supposed to be in the home and in the church. And then pray. Pray for one another. Pray for one another.
And I think that it's time we start crying for our nation and bow our heads and pray. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? Like a plant one day we'll wither away, and to this world we'll have to say goodbye. But just like the plant that withers away, we will leave many seeds behind. If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? If today you lost your life, what would you leave behind? What would the ones around you see? What happened in the dash between your birth and death? What will you do to change your legacy? What will you do to change your legacy?